Okay, tell me your name one more time.
My name is Hassan Basajic.
Okay, and what are you doing here in Antarctica?
I'm a science technician for the long-term ecological research project in the McMurdo Dry Valleys.
And what specifically does that entail?
I take care of several weather stations. There's about 14 of them. And I maintain all the sensors on there and make sure that they're running. So I visit each station, download the data, and make sure everything's running smoothly.
And what kind of sensors are out there?
We've got air temperature, usually at 3 meters, as well as our relative humidity. And then we monitor the amount of light coming in at each station as well. So we have incoming shortwave radiation, and then what's being reflected off the ground, as well as at some stations, longwave radiation, and both incoming and what's being given off by the ground. And in addition to that, we've also have sensors, certain sensors on some of the land-based sites that measure the photosynthetic range that's important to plants. So it's a certain wavelength that we monitor for the folks that are interested in the biology.
Cool.
And then we also measure precipitation, and we've got several weighing buckets that measure the amount of incoming precipitation. And then we also have these sonic rangers that measure the distance from the sensor to the ground. And so those actively, they send out an acoustic pulse and they tell you how far it is from the sensor to the surface. And if snow accumulates, then we could assume a certain density of the snow and get at an accumulation and then see how long that snow potentially sticks around.
Anything else?
I'm going through the sensor in my head. air temperatures. So we also measure, on the glaciers, we measure ice temperature at various depths to see how it changes. And then on our land-based stations, we measure soil temperature, both at the surface and then at 5 centimeter increments down to 20 centimeters.
And then classic weather things like wind speed and velocity.
And direction.
And
wind direction, wind speed, and that's taken every 4 seconds, whereas all the other measurements are taken every 30 seconds, and then all averaged up into 15 minutes. So we have continual 15-minute data year-round.
So you said that some of the places were on glaciers and some of the places were on land. Can you just kind of describe a couple of the places where those things are located?
Sure. All the stations that we have, our project is based here in the McMurdo Dry Valleys, and the valleys are made up of Taylor Valley, Wright Valley, and Victoria Valley, as well as several others, but those are the ones that our group focuses on, and mainly our group focuses on the Taylor Valley. So the valley runs east-west, and we have a total of 14 stations now, so the majority of them are in Taylor Valley. There are 4 that are on glaciers, on Commonwealth Glacier, Canada Glacier, Howard Glacier, and then up at Taylor, where we were the other day. And then in between all those, we have land-based stations as well. And so they vary. Most of them are near the lakes, which folks are studying, and then others are more remote. Going up as far as Beacon Valley, which is the last dry valley before you get to the polar plateau.
So how long has this stuff been being measured?
Well, it's a long-term project, so... you need water?
No.
Oh, for me? Yeah. It's a long-term project. So the LTER started here in 1993-1994 season. And so some of the stations were put in that year, and they've been running ever since, more and more coming online up until about 2003. And then we've kind of settled at 14 stations now. Some of the stations that we acquired were from previous researchers. So our record goes back as early as 1986 here at Lake Hoare. Mm. So that's really valuable information.
And what's the purpose of doing all this?
Well, the broader purpose of the LTER is to understand the ecosystem, since we're considered kind of an end member of the ecological spectrum. We're in a polar desert, so it's extremely cold, it's water limited, and then for half of the year it's light limited. So what looks like a somewhat of a dead place is actually a very simple ecological ecosystem. It's a simple mm-hmm. ecosystem. So you could study the processes very simply, whereas in more complex systems, it can be difficult to pull different things apart.
So, you mean like systems that have humans involved?
Yeah. Well, there could be an anthropogenic presence, or just that there's a whole lot more going on, where here in the Dry Valleys, the as we talked about, largest critter, so to speak, mm-hmm. is the nematode, which is a microscopic worm. So everything else happens at a much smaller level than other things. We don't have grasses and trees and things like that, so we don't have any large mammals, mm-hmm. except for things that are passing through very quickly. Mm-hmm. It's basically the purpose of having all this climate information is so that we can understand if there's changes that are going on, and then we could look at how the ecosystem responds to those climatic changes, both on the short seasonal term and both and on the longer term. So,
how does that tie into this energy balance thing? Is ecosystem and energy balance kind of the same thing, or?
Energy balance is different, and energy balance is, as we apply it, is to the surface of a region. And the most important for us, why we look at energy balance, is the main limiting factor for the Dry Valleys, is for life in the Dry Valleys, is water.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to keep tabs on where water's coming from, how much, and when it's coming into the system. And so my other half. So my other half of the job is monitoring the glaciers. And we monitor the glaciers twice a year. When we first come in, we measure stakes that are put into the glacier, and then we measure them again at the end of the season, and we look at that change. And so we have an idea of how much ice is being turned into water, and potentially can enter into the lakes and the streams and lakes.
Mm.
And so that water can then be used. So. That's the main reason why we got into energy balance, is because understanding what's happening at the surface of the glacier, you can model then how much melt is entering, how much melt water is entering into the system.
So energy balance means melt, or means how much heat is getting generated?
Yeah, energy balance is in a broad sense, how much energy is entering into the system and how much is leaving.
Mm.
And so if you have extra energy into a surface, then you have energy available for ablation, either sublimation or melt.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look at the different parameters. So you have shortwave radiation coming in, and then some being reflected, and that reflection gets into albedo.
Mm-hmm.
There's long wave radiation, which again is being reflected off of clouds and then entering the surface and then being given off by the surface. And then you have two fluxes. You have latent heat and it's going to take me a second to recall the other one now. Yeah, I'm not going to remember the other one right off
okay.
my head right now. But you have these two fluxes that are dependent upon wind speed.
Uh-huh.
It's going to bother me now. But basically you have these components, and when you balance them out, you if you have any excess energy, that's what's available for ablation.
So how do you, I guess I'll ask you this one first. What's the difference between measuring all these parameters for climate and studying an ecosystem and being like a you know, a meteorologist doing forecasting or observing the weather for aviation purposes or whatever.
That you're putting it a little bit different that way. So there's not a whole lot of difference between. Well, let me think of that just for a second before I start talking about. The main thing that we're trying to do is monitoring long term climate, as opposed to seeing what the weather will be like the next couple of days. So a meteorologist will look at the weather and then based on a certain set of models try to predict what's going to happen the next couple of days. For aviation purposes, they'll have someone, you know, go outside, look at what the conditions are, and then look at a set of variables similar to what we measure.
Right.
Our focus is trying to understand the ecosystem and then certain processes that occur down here. So we will measure very similar things, air temperature, wind speed, barometric pressure, but in addition we'll also look at things like that photosynthetic range of the spectrum and really get more at what's going on as far as cloudiness, how much solar, you know, getting at that energy balance, and trying to understand, getting to understand melt is
right.
One of the key things we're trying to do.
Right, but when you look at the data and stuff, I mean, do you guys care about discrete events like, you know, dust storms or whatever like that, the way that, you know, someone with aviation would, or are you sort of just averaging that stuff, or?
We're zooming in and out. Specific events can be really important for what happens here. You know, we're interested in the long-term climatic, you know, what's going on with the temperature and what's going on with the precipitation on the long term. But there can be those short events. For an example, there in the 2001 season, it was a really warm summertime down here during December and January. And that set off a large melt event where there was the area had a huge amount of influx of water, and so that could be considered one long event. It's not a single day, but that one season had an effect that cascaded for several more seasons, and we're still kind of feeling that that big melt season in some ways. Shorter term events that can happen are from katabatic events, which are down valley winds that are really strong that are coming off the polar plateau. And these winds can last for 2 to 3 days, and it's dry descending air, so it warms up the air down here. And it could be, in the wintertime, it could be very cold, about minus 40 degrees Celsius or Fahrenheit. It's pretty close down there. And it could warm it up to 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So a huge jump for a very brief amount of time in the middle of winter. And so our instruments are really important. We'd have no idea those things went on if we didn't have them running down here. And that it's also really important during the summer is those katabatic events, because they sometimes turn on the melt.
So as somebody who's been studying climate and looking at this data for a while, I mean, how do you understand climate? Are you, does the LTR now have like sort of a static idea of what normal climate is for this area, or is there even such a thing as normal climate?
We have a good idea of what's happened over the past, you know, 12 years, because that's what we have data for. And during that time, we see that there's a slight cooling trend. It's let's see how to put this. So there's a slight cooling trend over the past 12 years, and within that there's very cold years and very, you know, warm years, such as the 2001 season, which was an exceptionally warm year. We call that year the big melt year here because it was significant. Some years get nicknames because they stand out. Every season seems to be a little bit different. We know that those melt years had occurred in the past, in the mid-80s from researchers that were down here, and that they were actually more common throughout the mid-80s. these larger melt events. So they're seen as episodic, and we don't know how common they are. So that's kind of what we do know.
Yeah. So, like, would you say that when people talk about climate change as being like a kind of a new thing, that it's really is always changing, or?
Yeah, climate has always been changing, especially when you think about long time scales. And so we talked about scales a little bit, going in and out of different time scales and viewing things through different lenses. So, you know, 1 year, if you compare on a year-to-year basis, things will seem very different, or maybe not. But I'm trying to think of how to get back to your point here. What was the main question you just asked?
Yeah, I guess that talking about that idea of scale for for understanding, you know, what climate is, because I think a lot of people think that you know, sort of myself included. Well, I don't really know, but you know, there's a strong idea among people that climate is this
fixed
sort of static thing, and then you have fluctuations around it, but it's, you know, basically you could say here's an average climate for the Dry Valleys, you know, period. But,
right.
I mean, is that really the way that, that the scientists understand it now, or is it sort
well,
of
it's, yeah, it's more... This is the average climate for this period of time. We could say this is the average climate for the past 10 years, and this is the trend that's going on right there. And if we look at the last 50 years, it could be a totally different trend, right? Because you have all these other years. You have many things influencing the climate as a whole. You have these different atmospheric patterns and ocean patterns that are shifting on sometimes on cycles that are somewhat predictable and sometimes not, and they all interact and all interact with each other. So you have lots of these oscillations going on, and climate can be affected by that. So it's important to, when you look at weather, that climate is something, it's long-term weather, and it can be affected by lots of different things going on. So. It can be very complex and difficult to understand and difficult for folks to tease apart.
Is this a really sensitive climate here? Like, if there are things that go out of balance, you know, could these the life that's here be wiped out, or?
It's what we did find during that cooling trend is that certain species were favored and other species were not, and so the numbers, the populations did change. So yeah, we know that things will change as the climate does, and because it affects how much melt is available, it affects that, which in turn affects the geochemistry. So yeah, anything that goes on, it can have a cascading effect on the ecosystem. There's one other thing I wanted to, I have caught on to in my brain. That's
yeah. Are those I mean, those nematodes, are they important? I mean, should we be worried about them?
Yeah. Well, that's yeah. So that's what I was referring to. And I forget. There's Scott Nema and I think it's Urolimus, but I'm not the biologist. I forget the names of them.
Okay.
Yeah. So one favors moist conditions and certain salinity levels, while the other likes drier conditions. And so normally Scott Nema is the dominant nematode in the area, and so the levels of the populations of those species changed over this cooling trend. And so that's the great thing about a long-term project like this, is we have long-term climate data and we have long-term monitoring of the same things every year, in addition to experiments going on. So that's one of the strengths of the project.
So with these instruments, let me talk to you about the instruments, because like, this is something that's kind of interesting to people. But it seems like, I mean, do you just take an instrument and plop it down and then get the data and know exactly what's happening?
I wish it was that simple. So yeah, we have the Met stations set up, and someone else before me set mm-hmm. them up. And so what my job is to, I come and with, we have calibrated sensors that we bring in every 2 to 3 years. So I'll visit the site and I'll swap the sensor out, and then the data is logged into a data logger. And so while I visit, I swap out a storage module, bring the data back here, download the data, and I'll do a quick comb through to see that the instrument's working right. And if there's a problem, then I'll schedule another trip back out to the site to try to figure out what's wrong with it and replace it if necessary.
What's the calibration process?
The calibration process is where, for most of the manufactured ones, we will actually send it back to the manufacturer, and they'll run several tests on it and, you know, sign off that it's still operating to certain conditions. Mm. Most of the sensors here are tested to the very cold conditions, to -40°C and below. And so they'll come back to us, and then we'll install and swap them out.
So is there an error, percentage error that these
yes.
instruments have?
Yeah.
And how do you deal with
it? It depends on the specific sensor and what that percentage is. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to minimize them as much as possible, but typical errors are, for some, especially the solar radiation sensors, are around 4%. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of what you're dealing with. It's just the nature of it. More expensive sensors will reduce that error generally. Mm-hmm. For a deployment like this, where you have up to 14 stations, the standard is kind of moderately expensive sensors. They're still expensive, but you try to go with what's standard, so you can pair your data to other people's data in other locations. So you try to balance getting the best data possible and being able to compare it to other data. You have these errors. So you have to constrain your data within that error and be mindful of it when working with the data. Mm-hmm. There's also post-processing involved that I do mm-hmm. after the data is collected. I'll go through the data, you know, once initially to see if there's problems, but then I'll come through it for several more months.
And looking at it by hand and
graphing it out, uh-huh. Comparing it to other stations, flagging data that's wrong, and eliminating mm-hmm. it from the final data set. And then, so I'll go through it several times for each station, each parameter, and then flag, remove what's necessary, clean it up, and then apply any post-processing factors that go into it. There's different methods for analyzing data or for removing certain errors. Mm. And so we'll do that after the fact, after we collect the data, then we'll clean it up. So we still have the original data of what the instrument actually collected, but right. we also have this post-process data, and so that's what eventually gets moved out.
Why can't you just write a computer program to do that post-processing?
We do run macros, uh-huh. There's things that you can never anticipate, so you definitely need the human eye to go over it. The post-processing is put, so the data, I look over the data, make sure that there's, you know, no problems, but I do move it through a large macro which combs it mm-hmm. and filters out and actually flags things automatically that alerts me to certain things. So I'll have an idea if something's gone wrong or out of range, or if two parameters don't look right. I'll get a flag, and some of them are just warning flags, and some of them are like, this data is bad. Mm-hmm. So that does definitely cuts down on the amount of time that I have to put in, but you definitely need a human eye on it to make sure that it's still coherent.
Yeah, did you hear that story about the when they were collecting the ozone data? The British.
Just recently, yeah, they found out the way they
calculate. Was there something recently? I was thinking about way back in between the 70s and the 80s.
There's something up that has come up again.
Oh, yeah?
That's what I understand, yeah. I heard about it a little about this season. that, yeah, the way something is calculated isn't quite right, and so we're a little bit off on our predictions.
Oh.
I think it might be how the rate at which the ozone hole is shrinking. I know they're re-examining that hole right after the past couple seasons of it being very large. Yeah, but yeah, so the idea is that you always collect, you always keep your original data, and that's right. what you want to make sure that's available for people in the future, because if the method that you're applying to post-process your data is wrong, you want to be able to go back to that original data that was collected to see if you could apply a different method to it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And how often do people, you know, like you and Matt were talking about today, how often do people come in and do experiments that kind of test the instruments?
Right.
Or question the instruments.
It's folks usually do it when, if a new instrument comes online or if they want to switch to a new sensor, they'll usually do experiments to do a side-by-side comparison under different conditions to see what the errors are that are different. In our case, Matt has a really great instrument that is much more accurate than the sensors that we have out here. So we could measure things across a wider spectrum more accurately, and so we could compare the data that we have been collecting against this more accurate device and see how the data compare. And for the broad climate sense, the data that we're collecting is great, but for Matt's work, he's looking at very subtle changes and very subtle differences in the data. So it's the things that he's looking for, this device is great to be able to do those comparisons. So it's common until something becomes very widely known, and when the sensor is known inside out, then folks generally accept certain types of sensors as being standard. Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's really good. Is there something else that you think I've missed? Or?
I could never think of those. Whenever I get asked those questions, I could never think of them. I was like, I don't know.
I think that was good. I really like the energy balance explanation.